Hey, this is Evan Phillips from Anchorage, Alaska. You're listening to The Fern Line. Alaska, the highest concentration of big, remote mountains in North America. For generations, a unique group of climbers have tested themselves in these vast alpine arenas. The Chugach, St. Elias, the Hays, Neocola, the Kachatnas, the Revelations. Their stories are etched on high alpine walls. Their visions follow lines of cold gray ice. What inspires them? What makes them come back? Who survives? Who suffers? These are the stories we'll tell on Season 1 of The Fern Line. It's springtime in Alaska, but you're working 60 hours a week. Finally, you get a three-day weekend. Just enough time to get after that new mixed line you spotted on Ptarmigan Peak. But the high-pressure system that's been holding steady for the last month turns into a record-setting blizzard.
Shut down again.
Lucky for you, the Alaska Rock Gym is there to keep your head strong and your arms pumped. Providing quality indoor climbing to the Anchorage community since 1995, the Alaska Rock Gym sports 20,000 square feet of climbing, an entire floor of bouldering terrain, beautiful locker rooms, and expanded cardio, fitness, and yoga rooms. Check out the Alaska Rock Gym on the web and social media, or stop by for a tour. We'll see you at the gym. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On Season 1, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of what's possible in Alaska's mountains. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with extraordinary people, folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in one of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. All right, so before we get started today, I just want to give a shout out to a few Fernline listeners. Kevin Foote, thanks for reaching out and letting me know how the podcast is bringing back some nostalgic memories from your college years in Alaska. That's really awesome to hear. I want to give a shout out to Bob Goodwin. Bob and his climbing partner just drove 2,700 miles from Montana to make an attempt on Denali. Thanks for reaching out to say hello, and I'm happy to give you the beta on the great places to get coffee and go rock climbing while you're hanging out in South Central Alaska. And finally, I want to give a shout out to Allie Lee. Allie runs logistics for Sheldon Air Service in Talkeetna, and she reached out to tell me how much she's enjoying the show, and also gave me a few suggestions on some folks I might consider interviewing. So yeah, I love hearing from you. Please continue to reach out. If you want to get in touch, you can send me an email at thefernline@gmail.com. If you want to help out, there's a few easy ways to support the show. The first is to leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Reviews are a great way to let potential listeners know that the podcast is a quality listening experience. The second way you can help is by simply telling a friend. Word of mouth is the best way to promote the Fern Line, and it helps build the grassroots community vibe that I'm going for. So make sure you let someone know. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch or camp chair and settle in for the next hour on this episode of The Fern Line. On today's episode, we'll get to know one of Alaska's most prolific alpinists, Mark Westman. Over the span of 20 years, this Talkeetna-based climber has quietly amassed an Alaska Range tick list that is arguably unmatched by anyone. On Denali alone, Westman has climbed a myriad of monumental routes, including the Cassine Ridge, the Denali Diamond, the Isis Face, and the Slovak Direct. He's climbed new routes on Mount Huntington, Mount Silverthrone, as well as the third ascent of the stunning South Ridge on Mount Hunter. But like the alpinists he looks up to, Westman prefers to let his climbing do most of the talking. That's why I felt fortunate when Mark agreed to spend an afternoon chatting with me at his home in Talkeetna, Alaska. I drove out there on a snowy December morning, hoping to gain insight into the motivations that inspire Mark's climbs. But I also wanted to catch a glimpse of Mark as a person, and I wasn't disappointed. We started the conversation by talking about Mark's childhood interest in the outdoors and how that led to his first adventures in the mountains.
When I was about 7 years old, my father had taken me to Yosemite Valley, and I don't remember a whole lot about the trip, although I do remember the big rock walls. And I don't remember thinking about rock climbing at that point, but I know it was just a few years later that during recess and lunch break and so forth during school, and where other kids were out playing ball or whatever, I was sneaking off to the library and checking out rock climbing books. And I remember specifically this one that had the famous picture of a climber's boot while looking down the nose from the 1960s. I believe it might have even been from the first ascent. It's a famous photo. And I remember, you know, wondering how I could ever do something like that. But really, it just came from, the inspiration just came from being out there day after day and like looking at maps. I was a map fiend. I just loved to look at maps and plan trips. And so by the time I was about 11 years old or so, the trips that my brother and my dad and I were doing were largely of my design. I was the one that was like, I was always designing these trips that my brother and my dad would get mad at me later because I would just, you know, plan these impossible schedules.
Yeah.
You know, 15 miles a day and and so forth. The stuff that I would have a hard time with. And so, but I didn't actually get to go climbing until after college. And my father, I think, was a little bit worried about what would happen if we went climbing. I mean, he none of us had climbed before, and we were just dealing with backpacking. But I would suggest, like, hey, let's take this rock climbing course. When I was, you know, 12 years old, I was going to the Palisades School of Mountaineering's office in Lone Pine or Bishop, and getting the literature and saying, hey, there's an introductory rock climbing course. And he would say, well, yeah, we'll see about that. And then it never happened. And I know I even rode away to RMI when I was 12 to see if we could get on a Mount Rainier trip. Because when I was, I should back up and say one of the big inspirations was when I was growing up, my dad's parents lived in Tacoma. That's where my father grew up. He grew up in the Pacific Northwest. And as a graduate of the University of Washington, he had a lot of roots there. And so I used to visit my grandparents in Spanaway. And right out the back of their mobile home, you had a great view of Mount Rainier. And my grandfather loved going to Mount Rainier. And so every single trip that I went as a child, I can remember them all the way from when I was 2 or 3 years old, we would drive to Mount Rainier every time, rain or shine, and walk through that visitor center and read about mountaineering. And so Mount Rainier was like the kind of the big thing. That was the thing I ultimately saw myself doing. I didn't look beyond that at the time, but it's funny because it actually ended up becoming a central part of what got me into climbing was Mount Rainier.
Cool. It sounds like you were interested in climbing as a kid, and you know, had the desire to maybe check it out or do it. But when did you first actually try it?
So I got swamped with my college responsibilities. I was a civil engineer studying civil engineering at the University of Washington. Not really an accident that I ended up in Washington. My brother was already going to school at the University of Washington. My father was an alumni, and so I kind of naturally gravitated that direction when I was 17. And while I was in school, I met a guy named Mike Gauthier. It was my freshman year, 1987. We actually met while playing intramural football. And also, he was in one of my chemistry classes. And we got to know each other pretty well and became pretty good friends through college. And at some point through college, when I was maybe about 20, I'd gone up to Mount Rainier with my father and a few of his friends to hike up to Camp Muir. And going up to Camp Muir was like a big deal to us. Like we were going above the tree line on Mount Rainier, but we didn't know anything about climbing. And I ran into Mike there. And I didn't realize in the years that I'd known Mike that he had just become a Park Service employee. And I saw him standing in the parking lot and he said, I said, what are you doing here? He says, I'm a climbing ranger. And I said, what's a climbing ranger? I have no idea what that is. And he said, I get paid to climb the mountain and I do search and rescue and I talk to visitors. And I was like, that's a thing. I had no idea that that there were such a thing. And so,
and I'm assuming that you thought that that sounded like a pretty cool thing.
Oh yeah. No, I was fascinated. Plus I suddenly remembered like, yeah, that's right. I wanted to climb Mount Rainier like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't until Mike kept continued to badger me for the next 2 years, during which time I was just so engrossed with civil engineering work that I couldn't think of much else. And, but in the summer of 1992, I graduated and Mike was like, you have to come up and climb Mount Rainier with me. And I was like, absolutely. So I did. A week after I got done with school and graduated, I came up and we weren't able to make it to the top. The weather came in. And so I decided to cancel my next weekend's plans and went right back up and ended up, the weather wasn't good that weekend either, but I just somehow sent a message out to my dad so he wouldn't worry too much and said, I'm not going to come home until the weather gets good and we get up this thing. So I just stayed up there all week until the weather got good. And then Mike and I went to the top of the mountain from Camp Sherman up the Emmons Glacier on a very cold, windy day in the middle of the week. And we were the only ones on the mountain in the middle of July. And we had to break trail in cold weather the whole way. We were the only ones we saw all day. And so that was like climbing Mount Rainier for me for the first time was this isolated experience. And so it was very different than it could have been on a weekend, you know, in the summer. It could have been, you know, another, you know, 200 people up there with us. But anyway, I cleared my calendar for the rest of the summer and decided to just keep coming back up and hanging out with Mike and at Camp Sherman. And over the next 2 years, basically, that's all I did was climb Mount Rainier and hang out with the climbing rangers and get comfortable. Because this, I should say that being on a glacier at this point in my life was still kind of a terrifying experience to just actually be there. That seemed really, really serious. And I wasn't even thinking about technical climbing at this point.
So. Yeah. You know, when I talk to climbers, they talk about when they had a light bulb moment about, you know, this is something that I'm going to do. Did you have that experience at all in your life? And was it related to Mount Rainier at all?
I did, and I believe it entirely happened at Mount Rainier. But what happened there, it wasn't just the mountain and just climbing. I met a group as I started to like hang out here at Camp Sherman with the Rangers, and then eventually in 1996, actually 1995, I should say, and I became a climbing ranger myself. And how that happened is somewhat of a long story, but the short version is that I lost my job as an engineer. I'd been working for 3 years out of college for a consulting firm, and all I was doing was climbing on my weekends. But I got laid off, and about a week later, two guys who I knew who worked at Mount Rainier, Sean Ryan and Phil Otis, were killed on the Emmons Glacier while trying to do a SAR. And Mike called me and said, I need help up here, and I know you just lost your job. Can you help? And I said, he's like, you know this camp better than anybody else that I can think of. And so, of course, I wanted to help. So I went up, and they emergency hired me for the rest of the season. And the first weekend I worked as a climbing ranger, I spent the first day sorting through Sean and Phil's gear exactly the way they'd left it the night of their accident, because nobody had collected their personal belongings yet. And so that was obviously kind of an eye-opening experience. And then the following day, I watched three people fall 2,500 feet to their deaths down the Emmons Glacier right in front of us, and then got involved in that search or that rescue. And that was a traumatic weekend for me, actually. It almost ended climbing for me, actually. I had nightmares about that for weeks afterwards. But I managed to rally, and in the course of working at Mount Rainier, I formed like the core relationships in my life, I think. And that was a group of people. It was Mike Gauthier, of course, but also David Gottlieb, Joe Purrier, Chad Kellogg, Lara Kellogg, Dee Patterson and Stoney Richards, and quite a few other people, too numerous to name really. But that core group of people I would go on to work with them for the next 3 or 4 years as all of us working on the mountain together. And in particular, Joe Purrier and I became very close friends and climbing partners. And we started spending all of our days off climbing outside of the park in the North Cascades and working our way up to bigger things and also going to Alaska.
I am the lonely one, come from the high ground. I got a feeling in my head when you come around. You can rely on me all the time. Woo!
There's a classic mountaineering saying, there's old climbers and there's bold climbers, but there's no old bold climbers. I'm not sure I totally agree with that, but there's something to be said about learning patience in the mountains. For Mark, this lesson came on the flanks of Denali in the mid-90s. After getting pounded by bitter cold and high winds on the Harper Glacier in 1994, Mark chalked up the lessons and started plotting his return to the high one. Success came 2 years later when Mark and his partner, Joe Purrier, completed a 28-day traverse of Denali via the rarely climbed South Buttress. Although the climb was a turning point for Mark and the beginning of a lifelong obsession with climbing hard routes in the Alaska Range, it was his emerging partnership with Joe that would leave the most lasting impressions.
Joe was like my best friend, and we had all these things we wanted to do. And so it started after this trip, it started for the two of us an incremental progression through climbing that I don't think we had envisioned prior to this. But when we came out of that, all of a sudden we came home from Alaska and went to work at Rainier together. And we were like, we had every weekend planned together, and we managed to get our schedules aligned at the park so that we had the same days off. And we went and we had a long list of things we were going to tick off in the North Cascades. And then we started talking about going to Yosemite to go big wall climbing and go to Aconcagua to find out if we could climb at altitude. And of course, Alaska was like the thing that had these big dreams in Alaska. You know, we didn't know if they were possible. But we started working our way towards these things right away.
Sounds like from an early time in your climbing career, partnership and your partnership specifically with Joe is a huge deal to you.
There's a special motivating factor when you have someone who's just as interested in this as you are, and you know, who has the same sorts of goals and ideas and things like that. We just work exceedingly well together. I mean, after we spent 31 days together on Denali and we never had a single argument, I think we knew that we had good things in store for us.
I mean, did you make a decision at some point in time? You're like, well, I could, there's expedition style climbing and there's alpine style climbing. And was there a transition for you of kind of going from an expedition style to realizing, oh, this is more what I want to do?
Absolutely. So the 1996 trip up the South Buttress of Denali, we weren't fixing lines, but we were double carrying most of the route because we had so much stuff. I mean, it was... this is at the same time one of the greatest trips I ever did, and also one of the lousiest in terms of style. And like, we had so much stuff. I can't even tell you. When I got off the mountain, we were out of food and nearly out of fuel, and all my personal gear combined, the stuff that I carried down from the West Buttress, was 110 pounds. So I believe we started with about 180 pounds apiece. And so we were double and in some cases triple carrying the route. And at the end of that climb, we were both, Joe and I were both really excited, but we were also like, there has to be a better way. And I have to give props to, our inspiration came from when we got out from that trip. Jeff Benowitz, who's a guy from Fairbanks, and his partner, Rick Studley, were gearing up on the porch at Talkeetna Air Taxi. And we were astonished by how little stuff they had. I mean, they literally had almost nothing. They had like a toothbrush sawed in half and all these clothes that I think were lighter partly because they were full of holes. But we were scratching our heads and looking at our pile of stuff going, how come they can do that? Like, why can't we do that? And so a year later, just a year later in 1997, Joe and I carried a lot of stuff into the Treleika Glacier in early season because we wanted to have the time to be able to wait out the weather. But we ultimately ended up climbing the west face of Mount Silver Throne. It was a new route, first ascent of the west face. It was about a mile high face. And we did it with only a shovel and a jacket in the pack. And the actual climb took us, you know, about 15 hours round trip. And I don't know what, like, for us, I mean, by modern standards, this is not a big deal at all. But for us at the time, for who we were and what we had done at this point, this was kind of a huge psychological step, especially since it was April 1st when it does still get quite dark.
And cold.
And the weather wasn't actually very good at all. And we summited in a complete whiteout and then had a descent ahead of us that was kind of unknown. We just decided we were going to head down to the left and try to get to this couloir that would drop us into our camp. And lo and behold, by luck a little bit, I'm sure, we managed to make it back to the tent in one piece right at last light. But that was a big instructional point for us right there. Like, see, we don't have to carry 100-pound packs up these things. And also, it's probably better that we don't, because moving faster is actually probably a lot safer. So Alaska has been kind of the one area where I kind of was measuring myself as a climber in terms of my progression and psychological capabilities and so forth. And I guess I can't say this is the best experience or the greatest or whatever, but one that stands out for me was when Joe and I climbed the Infinite Spur in 2001 on Mount Foraker. That was a huge turning point for me. And it was also, unfortunately, it was kind of like the end of, not the end, but the beginning of the end for my partnership with Joe. But Joe and I had been working towards something like that for many, many years. And, you know, this was, again, one of these routes that we had looked at as years earlier as like, that's something we'll never be able to do. And next thing you know, we did the Cassine in 2000 and it went really, really well. And we felt very competent. And we decided, like, oh, the Infinite Spur seems like the next logical choice of progression. And we were, of course, in that phase of like, you know, whatever we do next year has to be greater than what we did this year. And so we did the Infinite Spur, and that went also very well for us. We also got lucky, of course, as you know, luck's unfortunately part of the game, but we got good weather, I guess I should say. And we came away from that as just like, it was our greatest experience together, and it was kind of the logical end point for us in terms of our progression as climbers. But by that time, you know, it was the whole package for us. Like, we came down, it was like the signature on everything that we'd worked for together. And that's why I would say it was one of the greatest experiences we had. At the same time, it was a divergence point for me and Joe, as climbing partners. Like, we remained friends forever, but the after that point, for me, it was like a reset. I suddenly realized I can do the big technical routes in Alaska, and there's a lot I want to do, and there's suddenly a whole lot of things appeared on the list for me. And I also wanted to start going places like Patagonia. And Joe, I think at that point, was starting to get a little tired of the weather in Alaska, and he had bigger plans in places like the Himalayas. And Joe was, you know, in 2001, Joe was single. I was with Lisa, and I was planning on getting married, and eventually did. And so I felt like just the preponderance of my circumstances of wanting to have a house and things like that, like going to Himalayas didn't make sense for me. I didn't want to spend all this money and huge amounts of time to be away from home when I could be climbing a lot more in places like the Canadian Rockies and Patagonia and Alaska, and doing relatively shorter trips. It was just going to be easier for me domestically and on my wallet. For that reason, you know, I was like, I want to do the bigger, harder routes in Alaska. Joe's like, I want to go to the Himalayas. And so our goals, you know, diverged, so did the amount of time that we spent climbing together. And and to be fair, at that point, for the last several years, Joe and I had been basically climbing with only the two of us, nobody else. And I think we both realized that we were going to learn a lot more climbing with other people. So the downside of it was that it kind of ended up being the last big thing that he and I ever did together, really.
While Joe started exploring regions in the Himalaya and beyond, Mark continued plying his trade in the Alaska Range, forging strong partnerships with other alpinists, including Colin Haley, Eamon Walsh, and others. In the ensuing years, Mark would continue to challenge himself on climbs that were incrementally more difficult than the ones he'd done before. Although there were numerous successes in the mountains, Mark would eventually come to the fork in the glacier where the realities of life and climbing intersect.
In 2007, I was with Eamon Walsh. I was climbing the Moonflower Bibler-Clewin route on the north buttress of Mount Hunter. And we were on our second day and had planned to bivouac on the third ice field and then go for the summit on our third day. But as we reached the third ice field at about 7 o'clock at night, I noticed that the weather was changing, and there was a forecast for a storm to come in the following afternoon, which, you know, we thought we had plenty of time. But as I saw the clouds and the signs of everything were changing, and it looked like it was coming in sooner. So I radioed my wife at base camp, Lisa, and asked her what's the weather doing. And she said, it's still supposed to come in tomorrow. And I decided to trust what I was seeing rather than the weather forecast at this point. So Eamon and I talked about it and decided to head for the top that night. And because we thought, well, if we dig in here, we don't have a tent. We're just sleeping in bivy sacks and sleeping bags. And if the weather comes in right now, we're not going to be able to rappel or climb. And we're stuck in the middle of this wall. It's a very steep wall, and tons of spindrift comes down here if it even snows lightly. So we're like, let's get to the top, and later we could probably dig a cave if we have to. So we start up. We continue on our way up through the Bibler Come Again exit. And just as we finished climbing the last technical pitch onto the final ice shield at about midnight or so, the weather came in completely. And we were, basically the situation became desperate in a matter of minutes. And the wind was probably steady at about 40 miles an hour. It was early May, so it wasn't getting completely dark, but for all intents and purposes, it was dark. It was, for the next 5 hours it took us to climb the upper ice shield, which is only like five or six pitches. It's technically one of the easier parts of the route, but we were exhausted. We'd been climbing all day for the last 2 days. Those five pitches of climbing were like the hardest thing I think I've ever had to do in my life, both psychologically and physically combined at once. We were getting just relentless amounts of spindrift, 40 mile an hour winds. We were dehydrated and very cold. And basically it was nearly impossible to climb, but we knew we couldn't really rappel because we couldn't make V-threads in this situation. We only had one little kind of pretend headlamp between us. So we were climbing in this just dim twilight. And I don't even know how to describe it, but there was this film, Japanese film made a long time ago. And I don't even remember the name of it. I want to say it was made by Kurosawa, but it was of a guy wandering around in a storm, and then just, it was very dreamy, and he just lays down and dies. And I felt like I was in that film. I remember feeling like I was placing myself in that situation, and every lead was I would just take off from the belay and climb until my hands were so cold I couldn't move, and I'd bury both my tools and clip into them and then swing my arms around for a while. I couldn't place protection because my hands were too cold. And then I'd get to the end of the rope, and I couldn't see Eamon at the other end of the rope. And then I would put in a single screw and just belay him off of a single screw. And then Eamon would come up, and wordlessly we'd exchange gear or whatever. And one or the other of us would keep leading. Our eyes froze shut, our hands froze. I remember at one point Eamon, the only thing I think I remember us saying to each other at one point, Eamon said, "Is this ever going to end?" That statement was weird because I thought, I kind of wanted to end one way or the other. Because this is like hell right now. And there was I didn't even have time for the apprehension of wondering if we were going to get snow deep enough on top of the pyramid behind the cornice, to be able to actually dig a cave. As it turned out, of course, the snow was deep enough and we were able to dig a cave, but Eamon had frostbitten two of his fingers by this point. So I spent the better part of 4 hours digging the cave while he got the stove working, and, short story, we managed to get in there and jam in there, and then it snowed a meter. And now we're faced with this situation of either trying to climb up towards the top, from which at this point it was technically trivial climbing to the summit, but very dangerous avalanche terrain with all this new wind-loaded snow, or repel the North Buttress of Hunter in horrible Spindrift. And so the choices weren't good either direction, but we chose down because I thought the Spindrift was preferable to actually setting off a slab avalanche. And we did end up making it down in without any particular incidents, and made it down quite quickly, but it was really kind of a traumatic experience. And it came only 2 weeks after one of my closest friends, Laura Kellogg, who was Chad Kellogg's wife, was killed rappelling off the ends of her ropes in the Ruth Gorge. And I almost pulled the plug on climbing that season because of that. It was just such a terrible thing that had happened to our community, our group of friends. And so I already kind of felt a little weird about going climbing so soon after this happened. And then while I remember being in the middle of this upper face, just pounding my fists against the ice while I was belaying Eamon and trying to get my hands to warm up, and also just being so angry with myself for being in a situation like this so so soon after as well. It was kind of tough. And we got down from that, we had just done what was really the absolute classic ice climb of North America, one of the greatest alpine climbs in North America, maybe in the world. And yet it kind of took something away from the experience for me a little bit. It was like I suffered so much on this climb that I can't say that it was really that enjoyable.
How did you deal with that? All that stuff that you were dealing with, losing a really good friend, Laura, before that climb, getting yourself in that situation. How did you deal with that?
Well, I dealt with it by sticking my head in the sand and continuing to climb, basically. I don't know if it was good or bad, but I got through that, and I didn't get frostbite, which I was proud of, I suppose, but my hands were pretty beat up after that. They'd gotten so cold. And so, but a month later, I ended up climbing the Denali Diamond with Colin Haley, and I had to basically gear up for what was an even bigger climb. And yeah, that climb went really well. You know, Colin and I had been climbing together for a number of years. We were really close friends, and we'd done a lot of big ascents before Fitzroy and Patagonia and some other things. And so we just never climbed in Alaska before. And this turned out to be one of the bigger climbs. It was one of the biggest climbs I had done at the time. And also it was just the way it went off. We did the whole thing in 2 days. It became one of the best ascents I've had, all things considered. Just how everything went is one of those things that went the way you hope it will when you're planning it in the living room at home. But it was intense. And after the season ended, I had kind of a real emotional collapse, I suppose, afterwards, just internally. When I went down to Seattle to go back to work, I had some engineering work I had set up down there. And, you know, everything about what had happened with Laura and just the intensity of the whole season kind of crashed down on me a little bit. And I remember thinking, like, next year I need to kind of maybe dial it back a little bit, or at least I was in this stage of, like, everything had to be bigger. Each climb I was doing each year had to be bigger than the last one. And I suddenly had that, for the first time in my life, I had that moment where I realized, like, maybe that's not a sustainable or smart mindset to be operating in. Maybe next year I should at least keep it at the same level or less.
And how did it end up going the next year?
I think it went according to what I planned. The following year I did this route with Eamon, and Eamon and I came back and we did this route called the Isis Face on Denali, which is a big and serious route, but technically it's actually not that difficult, not compared to some of the other things. It was much easier than the Denali Diamond, for example. I would liken it in terms of technical difficulty to being slightly more difficult than the Cassine Ridge, for example, but probably a far, far more serious route because it actually involves a lot of avalanche terrain and some really weird nebulous snow mushrooms and other kinds of terrain. It's a lot more objective hazard, and it's much more remote too. But it, again, was one of these climbs that went exactly the way you planned it would go at home. It was a 2-day ascent in perfect weather, great conditions. It was a route that, just like Jack Tackle, who had tried it twice before he had climbed it on his third attempt, I had skied up to the base of it on two separate occasions in years past on two different seasons and turned around because I didn't think the conditions were good. And then even in the past few years, Eamon and I had been in the Alaska Range, registered with the Park Service to climb the Isis Face, and we never went near it because we just didn't think conditions were good. And so it was many attempts or intentions later, we finally got to do that, and it didn't feel like we were extended in any way. And that's what I wanted out of that season, was to not, unlike the year before, I didn't want to have an epic of any sorts, and so I succeeded in that.
It's a normal reaction for climbers to go through contemplation, particularly after facing mortality in the mountains. For Mark, this reflection surrounded finding a balance between his love for the mountains and the commitments he valued in his personal life. But it was also a time to reflect on the meaningful friendships he'd developed over the years, and this led to reconnecting with Joe Pereira. During 2009, the two friends started hanging out again, and by the time Joe left for an expedition to Tibet in 2010, they were making plans for future climbs in the mountains. But as fate would have it, they would never get that chance.
Joe was climbing. So Joe had been doing a lot of first ascents in the Himalayas and in China from about 2006, I believe it was, onward, with my friend David Gottlieb in particular. He had also been climbing with my friend Chad Kellogg, and Joe and Chad hadn't climbed together in a while, but David and Joe were climbing together a lot in the last few years, like 2007, 8, 9, and they were doing some remote things in the Rawaling in the Himalaya and a couple of other areas. And in 2010, they had gone to a peak called Lobuche Kong, which is a 7,300 meter peak in Tibet that had not been climbed before. And basically they, after acclimatizing and sitting in camp for a really long time, they finally got some weather and they decided to get on the peak, on the route for the first time. And, you know, they were, you know, completely in exploratory mode at this point, but they were climbing along a ridge unroped, and David had stopped for a second to deal with his crampons, with putting his crampons on, and Joe went on ahead to scout things. And apparently I didn't see the actual scene, but there was basically kind of some rock gendarmes. It wasn't particularly technical terrain, but then there was a snowfield, and David, when he started following along, he climbed around this rock gendarm and then was walking along the ridge in the snow following Joe's tracks, and they led right to a broken cornice. And his first thought, of course, was that Joe must have gone another way, because he just thought this was a drop-off, and then he realized that there were no tracks on the other side. And basically what happened was there was a in-cut couloir that was coming up the other side of the ridge, which was very precipitous. It was a very precipitous other side. The side they'd come up was very gentle. And this couloir had in-cut a notch into the ridge, and then the entire notch area had grown over with what apparently was a huge cornice. And so Joe presumably just didn't notice that and walked across it, and the thing broke. And so he fell about 700 feet to the glacier. And David had the ropes, but he didn't have the rock rack. Joe had fallen with the rock rack. So at great risk to himself, David actually rappelled the face, wrapping off knotted slings and ice screws to look for Joe, because he just, you know, even though it looked hopeless, he wanted to make sure that, you know, he wasn't going to leave him down there if he was alive. And he found Joe at the bottom, and he had died.
How did you respond to that?
Well, it was, you know, it's obviously devastating, and Joe's wife Michelle was a very close friend and one of our best friends. She and my wife Lisa had known each other much longer than I'd even known known Lisa, and so I got a call. I was climbing in Las Vegas actually with Lisa at that point, and we had about 5 o'clock in the morning. I got a phone call from Michelle, and she had just talked to David by satellite phone, and so she was obviously hysterical, and and told me, I don't know what to do. Joe just died. And so we had to set in motion this whole series of events to try to get Joe's body evacuated. And, it was a, you know, really tough time for me. I mean, we had just lost Laura 3 years earlier. And so this was another, you know, Joe is another person from this Mount Rainier group of ours that had passed away in very short order. And, you know, for me, there was a lot of, it was complicated, of course, because Joe and I had not climbed together much at all in the last few years, but in the previous summer and the previous year, Joe and Lisa and Michelle and I had actually shared an apartment in Seattle together. And, cause I was working as a temporary engineer and Michelle was working as a CPA in Seattle. And so the four of us actually shared an apartment, which was kind of a inside joke. It's back when Joe and I, back in the mid 90s, Joe and I used to joke that, we were practically like a married couple already, and we were one day going to be married to women and sharing a house, and we were going to have racks and climbing gear stashed at locations all over the world and so forth. And now here we were in this dumpy apartment in Seattle, but we'd made it work. And Joe and I had kind of grown back together a little bit that summer, and we actually got out climbing in the summer. This was in 2010. We'd actually gone out climbing to Washington Pass that summer in the North Cascades. And I think it was the first time we'd climbed together in a couple of years, like 4 years maybe. And we even began talking about like maybe doing a trip together, like something bigger. And so I was really looking forward to that, actually. That was kind of like, I'd missed my old partnership with him, and I know he'd missed it as well. And I think we were kind of coming back around after having done a lot of our own things off independent of one another. And, yeah, unfortunately it just didn't happen.
How often do you think about Joe in your life?
No, I think about him all the time. I mean, he's just his imprint and the time that we spent together and the things that we did together in the mountains, you know, have shaped everything that I've done up to this day. And, you know, I kind of wonder what would have happened if he had not died, you know, where we would have gone, whether we would have gone to the Himalayas like we were talking about doing, you know, where he would be today. You know, and it's certainly, I have to admit, you know, between, with that and also with the loss of Laura and then Chad Kellogg again in 2014, it's unavoidable that I, you know, it's taken a lot of the fun out of it for me a little bit, you know, a lot actually. And, it's just how it is, obviously, you know, when you just get hit with one tragedy after another, especially when it's these people that you spend a huge amount of your time with, and created a lot of memories with, it's pretty hard to come back from that and still feel the same about it. It's like you just kind of took out a whole lot of your youth right there. And Chad and Laura and Joe are not the only ones. You know, they were the closest, but there's been a lot of other people that I knew, not as well, but who were friends, Sue Knott, Karen McNeil, and many others, you know, who've not come back from the mountains. And it's just a continual reminder of, you know, I've had to, and I had to deal with the wreckage left behind of each one of these incidents. And, because the spouses of, you know, Laura, I had to tell Chad over the telephone while he was in China that Laura was dead. And, you know, and then, of course, Michelle, you know, just seeing what's left behind makes you think about your own responsibility within your own relationship as well. And it's heavy. And ultimately, as I said, it's you know, a whole pile of things come together to kind of make it not as appealing. And it's just eye-opening, I guess. It's like, guess what happens.
One of the traits among strong alpinists is knowing just how far to push yourself while still maintaining control of the situation at hand. This is a balancing act that Mark worked hard to perfect over the course of a 20-year climbing career. But what happens when a life-threatening situation pops up out of nowhere and you have zero control over the outcome? How do you deal with that?
This is a question that Mark would have to answer for himself in the spring of 2016.
A few years ago, I started feeling different emotionally and started feeling depressed for no apparent reason. And I could feel my body chemistry was changing, but I just thought I'm over 40. And, I was starting to have trouble sleeping. And again, one of these things, I just thought, well, I guess I'm over 40. That's what happens. And, metabolically, I didn't feel myself, but I just thought it's a combination of, I just had all these tragedies and I'm kind of struggling with, trying to decide whether I want to keep working here in Alaska and not being able to climb here and just a lot of different things, just feeling like changes in my life. And I just thought it was a result of these things. I was just going through some anxiety perhaps. And, speeding up to this past year, last fall, about a year ago, I started noticing that my heart rate was rising and at rest, rising to levels that had never been at in my entire life. And my sleep problems got to a pathologic problem. Like I was literally unable to sleep more than 2 hours a night. Sleeping pills didn't help. And while I was in Patagonia, while I was at the high bivouac on Fitzroy, in fact, I was laying in the tent completely hydrated and wondering why my pulse was 95. And forceful, and I could just feel that something was really, really off. And so when I got home at the end of the winter, Lisa and I had spent a good chunk of February in Hawaii, and during which time I was also still just not really feeling well. I came home and had some blood work done, and they said your hormones are off, and hormones are completely out of whack. And so they sent me for to an endocrinologist. And I go to the doctor in early April, and he immediately ordered a CT scan, and they found an 11 centimeter tumor growing on my left adrenal gland. And they didn't immediately diagnose it as cancer, but it's one of these situations. They like, we have to get this out of you immediately. Obviously it's huge. It's the size of a softball. And, so this got serious really quick. All of a sudden, I went in there kind of thinking maybe I have a pituitary problem. Maybe I'm just in my 40s and I have a hormone imbalance. I don't know why I have this, but turns out this was a hormone secreting tumor, which is what adrenal tumors do. And adrenal cancer, as it turns out, is one of the rarest cancers in the world. It's something like 200 to 500 cases a year worldwide. And so it's an orphan cancer. And as I was soon to learn, it has very few treatment options other than surgery. Chemotherapies basically don't work. Mortality rate of it in higher stages is absolutely dismal. And so in early May, I had to clear my calendar at this point. Now I'm looking at I'm obviously not going to be going on any of my patrols or anything else, but I'm also kind of like, I don't know whether I'm going to be alive there at the end of this year. I went down to Seattle. Lisa and I went down to Seattle, and Lisa also was trying to get ready to go to base camp. So there's no good time for this, but it came right at the midst of our work season. So we were in total chaos here. And so I get down to the University of Washington, and I had surgery on May 12th. And it involved an open adrenalectomy, which is basically they cut a 10 inch long incision in my abdomen diagonally. And I had to get way into the back and remove my adrenal gland and this tumor. And fortunately, it had turned out to, it had not spread anywhere else, because when it goes to stage 4, where it's in other organs, the survival rate of 5 years is something like 5% or something like that. And so, I got through that, and then, came home a month later and, went through radiation therapy, which, I wasn't originally sure I was going to have to do, but I talked to the experts in the University of Michigan who specialize in this disease, and there aren't many people who do, but I felt like I needed to find the most knowledgeable people. And they told me, you need to do radiation. And they did offer an oral chemotherapy drug that has very controversial statistics around it as to whether it actually works or not. And I decided that given the high likelihood of devastating side effects, as well as the fact that it likely won't work, about 20% of the cases get a response from this and the rest of them don't. I decided to reject the chemotherapy, and my naturopath is working with me to improve my overall picture. So she's doing a lot of blood testing and so forth. And, you know, now my life is basically every 3 months for the next 4 or 5 years, I have to get CAT scans and look for recurrence of the cancer, which unfortunately has a very high rate of recurrence. It's something like 40 to 80%, depending on who you ask. So it's obviously kind of a nervous process, but it's something I just have to deal with. And, you know, I hate to bring everything back to climbing, but one of the things that I realized while I was going through this was that all the things I had done in the mountains for so long had really prepared me well to some extent. I mean, it's not been all easy, obviously, but it prepared me well for dealing with this, for dealing with a life-threatening situation. This is obviously a whole lot different and a lot worse. The way I felt in April and May of this year, if you could just isolate the terrifying moment, the most terrifying moment you've had in the mountains, if you could just isolate that feeling in the moment that a rock whizzes by your head and just misses you, or you're under a serac and you feel it move or something, or you're on a slope that settles in the mountains, you know, when you're out skiing, you can isolate that feeling, but then you wake up every day and you have to live with that all day long. Because you've got this unseen thing inside of you that's trying to kill you, and it really is trying to kill you, and you can't do much about it. It's a prolonged period of having to manage fear and anxiety, and it's stressful, and it's you know, I wish I could like give more sage advice to that to people out there who are dealing with it, but you just have to wake up each day and breathe. And you know, Lisa's been so amazing throughout this whole process for me, just supporting me and helping me keep my mind on track. And it hasn't been all roses. You know, there's some days where I just feel, you sit there and you just think, this is hopeless. Like, this thing's going to come back and get me. And then there's other days one of the things that's been great about this fall is just being able to get out and get back to rock climbing again, especially after such a major surgery. I recovered actually really, really well from it. I was able to get back and spend a lot of time rock climbing, and one of the greatest joys of it wasn't just the climbing, it was just going through entire days and realizing that I hadn't thought about this all day. And that was a gift.
Out of the blue into the sun, everyone waiting to stay.
As my chat with Mark came to a close that day, I realized I was not only in the presence of a remarkable alpinist, but quite possibly an even more remarkable human being. I'd come to Talkeetna that day hardly knowing anything about Mark, but I left feeling deeply affected by his candor and honesty about his life. Like most people, I've struggled with my own demons, whether it was regretting decisions I'd made or being afraid to face situations head-on in my day-to-day existence. Talking with Mark reminded me that it doesn't really matter how hard you think your life is. You still have to get up every day and breathe and make a decision on how you're going to move forward. I guess what I'm trying to say is that my talk with Mark was pretty damn inspiring. Before we ended our conversation that day, I asked Mark to touch on one final thing, the most important relationship in his life, the relationship with his wife, Lisa.
Out of the blue, into the sun, everyone waiting to stay on. We were the kings of our
We've been together for more than 20 years now. We were on the quote-unquote 10-year plan. We didn't get married till we'd been together for 10 years, but we've been steadily together that entire 20 years, and obviously she's been the most important relationship in my entire life, both in terms of all things, I guess. And we've been climbing together. We've traveled together. You know, she's the foundation of everything I do. And I frankly feel like not too many partners I could have in life would be willing to have put up with what I've put her through in terms of being gone a lot and taking risks and not always being in the greatest mood. Sometimes sometimes I come home, I guess anybody who's done a lot of like big serious climbs can relate to coming back and having a bit of an emotional crash. And it's been a lifelong struggle for me to like be consistent through things. And so, but she's just gold and has, you know, kept me motivated and kept me honest throughout things. And in return, I've, you know, tried to keep my objectives and my time away to, you know, like I said, it was the Himalayas. You know, I just thought that's not where I want to be. And that's not fair to our relationship to be spending that much money and being gone for that amount of time. And to, you know, I needed to hold this whole thing together. You know, it's not super easy, but it's helpful that we do a lot of our own climbing together though. And, you know, she's been one of my best partners, of course. And you know, we spend every fall together climbing in the desert. And, her job as the base camp manager, she's been the Kelton base camp manager now for 17 years, going on 18.
Wow.
And, a lot of that kind of came about partly because I was in the midst of going to the Alaska Range every single year to climb. And for her, it was kind of like, well, she loved the Alaska Range, and her brother, you know, runs Talkeetna Air Taxi. And so, she's quite familiar with everything. And we'd climbed the Moose's Tooth and attempted Mount Russell. And so she loved being in the Alaska Range already. And so she thought, well, this will be a great way to, you know, be closer that we can spend. We actually got to spend a lot more time together because of that job. And so a lot of times, I would come up with one of my big alpine partners and we would help her set the camp up, and then we'd be in camp well in between climbs, and it was a great way for both of us to be able to spend a lot of time in the mountains. And we've built a life here. I don't know that I ever saw that Talkeetna was going to be my home. And to be fair, I still don't spend year round here, but here's the house and here's our piece of land. And and so it's home base, and it's affordable, and it works. And you know, I a long time ago I had this, you know, belief that we were going to find the ultimate holy grail of a place to live, you know, where it has the best climbing and the best jobs and everything else that we could do. But really at the end, you just have to pick a place that works and then travel to where everything, because you can't have it all good at all times. You could say, well, I want to live in Moab year round, but it's 110 degrees there in the summer. You don't want to rock climb there. So you'd have to go somewhere else anyway. You know, likewise, Talkeetna is close to the Alaska Range. It's where we work. There is some climbing up here, but, you know, frankly, cragging around Alaska is not exactly top notch. And so I always tell people the best rock climbing in Alaska is to drive to Anchorage and fly down to California or some other place. But it gives you some, we love the seasonal lifestyle. And that's, I think, really been the foundation of for us, has been able to, that we both thrive on that, on being able to travel and do new things and you know, have variance in our lifestyle as the year passes. And so being able to get out and get out of Alaska for a few months every year and go other places has been really key.
Cool.
But at the end of the day, she's, you know, she's my best friend, and, I couldn't have done any of this without her support. And, yeah, just love her for it.
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you enjoyed Mark's stories as much as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his immense alpine wisdom to your next adventure in the mountains. Don't forget to review the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and don't forget to sign up to my email list on thefernline.com. And finally, don't forget to check out my music on iTunes, Bandcamp, Spotify, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line.
You can rely me all the time. You can rely on me all the time.
Oh, and by the way, this song is dedicated to Mark and Lisa.
It's 3 a.m. I close my eyes. I
get back up when you arrive these mornings. A better spent together. And time goes by and the seasons change with the falling snow and the summer rays. I got a feeling I'll be with you forever. You can rely on me all the time. You can rely on me all the time. You can rely on me all the time. Up all night, sleep all day. There's one thing that I need to say. I love you for staying by my side.